are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This is one of my favourite shows to record of the year, our Christmas book recommendation special with the wonderful Elizabeth Perry, where we go through five non-fiction and fiction bestsellers, and Elizabeth suggests books you may not have heard of that you should definitely be considering buying this festive season. We also speak to Brighton-based writer Gabrielle Griffiths, whose debut novel Greater Sins is out now with Penguin. All the books that we've discussed on the show will be listed in the podcast show notes, so you can download the podcast from wherever you get yours. And we will also have a nice big post on Instagram with all of the titles we talk about, so you can easily find them and get them on your Christmas shopping lists. I hope you enjoy the show. Please do consider donating to Radio Reverb this Christmas. We rely on donations to stay on air and ad-free. You can follow us on Instagram at BTM Book Club. And if you have an idea for the show for the new year, you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. Enjoy the show. It's my favourite show of the year. I can't deny it. I absolutely love working on our Christmas recommendation special, not least because my gorgeous friend and bookseller extraordinaire, Elizabeth Perry, joins us on the show. And we've pulled together over the years a format which I think, and I know Elizabeth thinks, is actually really brilliant, because a lot of what we love to do is talk about books that everyone will have seen and talked about, but also alternative ones that you may not have heard about. So I am going to welcome and pass over the gorgeous Elizabeth to tell us how her recommendation special is going to work. Firstly, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. This is my highlight of the year. I look forward to it so much. What we've done is come up with five bestsellers and then a pair bestseller, well, not bestseller.
That's okay. Start again.
We'll edit. What we've done is come up with five bestsellers, and then I've paired a kind of lesser known alternative recommendation for both fiction and non-fiction. So 10 books in total, and I can't wait to tell you all about them.
Amazing. Are you ready to kick off?
Yes, I am.
Okay, let's start with fiction. And this is a book we mentioned quite a lot on the show over the year, not least because it's brilliant. But Yael van der Weyden's The Safekeep is a stunning novel. And I actually had the pleasure of meeting Yael earlier this year at The Coast is Queer, where you were also. And she was absolutely incredible in conversation and maybe one of the nicest writers I've ever worked with, which really helps.
Yes, I agree completely. I've seen her talk about the novel a couple of times this year, and it's always so interesting, and she's so charming. And I would listen to her talk about the same stuff over and over again, especially if it's about The Safekeep, which is just such a beautiful novel. Takes place 15 years after the Second World War, and a young woman is living in her late mother's house when her brother drops off his girlfriend for the summer. And initially she's very unimpressed with this, but sparks begin to fly. And it was just brilliant. It's fun, it's sexy, it's moving. And I completely adored it. It's a bestseller that really deserves to be selling as well as it is.
Absolutely, because it must happen quite a lot when books are just flying off the shelves and you've read them and you're like, oh, really, really guys, there are so many better ones.
Yeah, definitely. There are a few where I kind of think I just don't get what's magic about this one.
So what would you pair The Safekeep with?
So I am pairing this with a book called The Lilac People by Milo Todd, which is a book that at the moment I think only has a US publisher. So if you want to order it, you will need to ask your independent bookshop for some help getting hold of it. But it takes place in 1930s Berlin initially. There's a trans man called Bertie who works at the Institute of Sexual Science, and there's a really thriving queer community, and then everything changes when Hitler rises to power. The institute is raided, all the books are burned, so lots of people will have seen photos of book burnings, that was from the institute, and Bertie and his girlfriend escape to a farm in the middle of nowhere and spend pretty much a decade in isolation under false identities of an elderly couple. But then in the final days of the war, they come across a young trans man who's escaped from the camps and they take him in. And then the Allied forces that are liberating the camps are re-arresting queer prisoners. So the three of them have to try and flee to the US. And it's the story of their time during the war, but also what happened to them afterwards, and their like attempt to escape and survive.
My gosh, that sounds brilliant. So, how did you find out about this book if it's only published in the US?
So this was a wonderful regular who comes into the bookshop, and she wanted to order it, and she's got wonderful taste, and I read a lot of the same things that she does. And when I was ordering it for her, I thought, my gosh, this sounds incredible. So I ordered myself one at the same time, and the pair of us were waiting for that box from the US to come many weeks later. And then it did, and it was brilliant. So I think that's one of the joys of working in a bookshop is the recommendations go both ways.
So that is The Lilac People by Milo Todd. Moving on, we have a little bit of thriller, All the Colours of the Dark by Chris Whittaker. This book is everywhere, was everywhere this year.
Yes, it is. And Chris is fantastic. Another person that I think if you get the chance to see him in conversation, you should definitely take it. This, his most recent novel, is about a pair of best friends who, when they're teenagers, Patch stops the most popular girl at school being abducted and is abducted in her place. And his best friend, Saint, goes out of her way to try and find him and does. But when he's rescued, he's adamant that he'd been held captive with another girl, and there's no evidence of this other girl. And as the decades pass, and as Patch and Saint grow up, and their lives kind of go in different directions, Patch is always looking for this girl he's sure he was held with, and Saint is always looking for a way to kind of make Patch's life better again. So it's this really beautiful thriller and page turner, but it's also a story of friendship and trauma and the ways we try and look after each other. And it's beautiful and also very gripping.
So this was a bestseller for a reason too.
For sure. Yes.
And what would you pair this with? So if you loved All the Colours of the Dark, what should you be reading?
I think you should read Heartwood by Amity Gage, which is a kind of wilderness survival thriller about a very experienced trail hiker who goes missing. She's in her 40s, her name's Valerie. And while she's alone in the wilderness, she writes these letters to her mother. So you get her narrative. And then searching for Valerie is this game warden called Beverly, who's quite a character. You get her chapters. And then the third person who kind of tells you the story is a 76-year-old bird watcher in a retirement community called Lena, who gets kind of swept up in online true crime investigation stuff and becomes a bit of an armchair detective. So the three of them, you start to figure out what's happened to Valerie, where she might be, whether or not it might be possible to save her. But it's also really beautiful nature writing. So it's not just this brilliant puzzle, wilderness survival stuff. There's this really beautiful writing about the landscape and about mothers and Barbara Kingsolver was a fan, so I really recommend it.
I love Babs.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so The Artist by Lucy Steeds, which actually is on my list, but I haven't read. Tell me more about this one.
It is wonderful. It's set in Provence in the 1920s, and a young journalist has gone to interview this very reclusive painter who. Oh, it's so hard to talk about without spoiling. I'm going to do my best because I think you would really enjoy it. But the journalist is at this house to interview the artist under the impression that the artist wants him there. And when he gets there, the artist is quite standoffish. But also living in the same house is the artist's niece, who kind of takes care of the artist, sets up his big tables of food so he can paint them. She does all the housework. She kind of facilitates his career. And the journalist becomes quite drawn to the niece, and stuff happens. And it's all about food and authenticity and who gets to be an artist and who gets to be a genius. It's beautiful. And also, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, it is kind of a thriller. There's definitely a page turner element to it. But the writing is just gorgeous. You feel the sun, you smell the food. It's wonderful.
Brilliant. Food writing done well gets me every time.
Yeah, me too. It's a real skill, and when it works, it is such a shortcut to being in the book.
Absolutely. Okay, so you have paired this with The Two Roberts by Damien Barr, also a guest at the Coasters Queer. Lovely thread here. We do have brilliant guests.
Yeah, you do. It was such a fantastic program. I mean, I went so excited to see writers I'd already read, and then discovered a whole bunch of stuff that I hadn't read yet that I'm now reading. Even other guests at the festival were writers that I've now read their books, and yes, it was such a special place. I've already booked the holiday off work for next year's festival, so I cannot wait. But yes, yeah, so The Two Roberts by Damien Barr is about two artists, Robert McBride and Robert Colquhoun, who meet at art school in Glasgow as young men. And the book kind of follows their lives and careers, rise and fall, bit of a rise, another fall, and is all about class and art and love and kind of found family, but also how things can fall apart, really. It is quite an emotional read, but it's also really beautiful. The writing about art is wonderful. The writing about their really strong personalities really brought them back to life for me. And Damien, I know, has curated an exhibition of their paintings, which I will absolutely be going to see. So yeah, it was fantastic.
So, number four on your fiction list is Death of the Author by Nnedi Okorafor. Tell me about this one.
So this is a sci-fi, but also quite a good one for people that don't consider them sci-fi readers. It's about a writer called Zelu, who she's Nigerian American. She comes from a very strong family who don't really understand her interest in writing. And she's disabled, and she's a bit of an outsider in her family. She's just had her latest novel rejected. So you meet her at the start of the novel, things aren't going great, and she decides to write a novel completely different to the rest of her work, which is a sci-fi novel, a kind of epic space opera drama about androids and AI after the extinction of humanity. This novel becomes really successful, really launches her career. And it introduces her to people who help her in ways that can become quite complicated as she gets more and more famous, particularly around her disability. And then fiction and reality kind of starts to blur. So it's all about storytelling, it's all about reality, it's all about, I guess, creation in the age of AI and what it means to be human. But it is fantastic. It's so compelling. I don't necessarily consider myself a big sci-fi reader, but I think this would please big fans of the genre, as well as people who maybe are a bit scared of the word space opera, which is fair enough. It's not for everyone. But I can't recommend it highly enough. It's brilliant.
It sounds absolutely brilliant. And you have paired this with a book called Moderation by Elaine Castillo.
Yes, so this is another novel that's kind of thinking about storytelling and technology. It's about a content moderator whose name is Girly, and she's kind of the best moderator you can find. She's so dispassionate, she's very disconnected, she's able to look at the worst of the worst on the internet and not be affected by it. She's got quite strong boundaries. And she's offered this big pay rise to start moderating a brand new venture that the social media company she works for is developing, which is like a virtual reality theme park of moments from history, extinct civilizations. So you can go kind of like around medieval places or Viking era and all sorts. And she's in the world, it's virtual reality, she's moderating live. But as she's working on it, this kind of dream, incredible new job, she starts to think that maybe something else is going on at the company. And at the same time, that her new boss, William, might actually be her soulmate, which is very complicated for someone like Girly with incredible boundaries. And William is also a man who's seriously guarded. So it's this excellent, thrilling story of social media companies and technology and storytelling and what that kind of does to civilization. But it is also at its heart the most romantic book. It's so charming and sexy, as well as all of the interesting tech stuff. I mean, Elaine has managed to combine two really big different genres into this perfect blend of a book. It's wonderful.
I'm completely sold, and I love how that title takes on so much meaning.
Yeah, for sure. It's a very clever title.
Really and brilliant. Okay, last but not least on the fiction, before we move on to non-fiction, we have got A Family Matter by Claire Lynch. Tell me about this book.
So this book is just beautiful, and I think probably is the book that made me cry the most this year. It's got two timelines. You've got 1982, where there's a woman called Dawn, who's a very young wife and mother, feeling quite stifled by her life in this village. And then another woman called Hazel appears and is kind of like breaks her world wide open. Their attraction is instant. Dawn kind of comes to life in a way she's not lived before. And then you get the more contemporary timeline, which is in 2022. There's a woman called Maggie who has always known her mother is an absence in her life that she can't really ask her father about. And then a letter arrives, which complicates everything. And you start to realize the way that these two timelines are connected. And it's all about family and the way queer families haven't been able to be together, and the legacy of secrets and shame, and the complicated relationships you can have within a family. And it's just stunning. It's such a good book.
And it's selling really well.
Yes, especially in the States, actually, where it has an incredibly different cover. So it's one of those books where I'm not sure the cover does a great job at telling you what the book is going to be like, but it is worth picking up.
Amazing. Thank you. Consider it picked. And you have paired this with The Correspondent by Virginia Evans.
Yes, another book where I feel like the cover doesn't necessarily do it justice, but I've just seen the new paperback cover, which will be on it next year, and I think is much better. So that's really exciting. I'm hoping new readers will find the book, which is made up of letters written by a woman called Sybil van Antwerp. She's in her 70s. She's very stubborn. She's incredibly opinionated. You really get that from some of her letters. And she's always believed in the power of the written word and in written communication. And then things become a bit complicated. It becomes apparent that Sybil is not going to be able to write letters for much longer. She has not got a lot of time to fix some things like her relationship with her children. She really wants to get onto a particular course at the local university who will not have her, and she's not having that, so she's still writing to them. And an old legal case that she worked on is coming back to haunt her as well. So it's a really clever way of telling a very complicated story. Sybil is not telling you everything, but through the letters she writes, you can read between the lines. And it's beautiful. It's beautifully written. Sybil is so real. It's often quite heartrending, but also very funny. And it's incredibly smart. It's a really intelligent, readable book. And the kind of book that I think you can give to lots of different kind of readers, and they'll love it. So if you're buying a book for someone who reads a lot and you just don't know what to get them, you should get them The Correspondent.
Amazing. Thank you so much. That is a brilliant list of fiction titles. Every time I get off the call to you, my TBR just grows and grows and grows. I'm going to be really cruel and say, you got to choose one. What would be the one fiction title that you think is the best book you have read this year that you want people to read?
Oh, this is so hard. Because there's also brilliant books that I didn't get to mention. Am I allowed to cheat and give you one that's not even on the list?
Yeah, of course. With
Okay.
the rules.
One that I couldn't fit in anywhere, it didn't match with anything else, and I wouldn't say it was a bestseller overall, although it sold very well in my bookshop, was a book called The Horse by Willy Vlautin. And it's about a man who is living quite an isolated life. And one day he wakes up and there's a horse outside, and the horse is not very well and it's being menaced by coyotes. And this guy really doesn't want to have to deal with it, but can't bring himself to leave the horse to an uncertain fate. So he starts to take care of it. And while he's taking care of this horse, he reflects on his life as a kind of traveling singer-songwriter. You get a lot of his story through the titles of his songs, but also the strange places he's played music, why he's ended up in quite this isolated way of living. And it's sort of a story about how caring for something else can make you care for yourself, which I think is a really good lesson that self-care sometimes is about looking after other people.
Brilliant. Right. We are going to be back very shortly with our non-fiction special. We are diving into our non-fiction Christmas recommendation special with the brilliant Elizabeth Perry. Number one on the list is Lone Wolf by Adam Wayworth. Tell me about this.
So this is a book about two things, really. It's about the specific journey that the author took, which is the same route walked by a young wolf in 2011. This wolf left Slovenia and walked for thousands of miles for 4 months and ended up in mountain outside Verona, so mountain range, northern Italy. There'd been no wolves there for a century, but just by chance, there's also a female wolf there on a walkabout of her own, and they repopulate the mountains. This is a kind of star-crossed lovers' story of this incredible journey, and it was just by chance that this wolf was one who had a GPS tracker, so we know about it. And so the author, Adam, in sort of 2020 in chunks walks this same route. But then the second part of the book, the bit that I found really compelling and I think makes it a book that lots of different readers, you don't have to be into wolves like I am, is he's looking at the friction between rewilding and local farmers, climate change, fear, migration, populist politics, looking at the way we talk about wolves and the way we talk about migrants and how all of this kind of ties together. I think he does a really beautiful job of writing about community and hope for change. But it is also just a great kind of nature travel writing book. So you could give it to someone who's interested in contemporary politics, or you could give it to someone who's interested in nature and wolves. And I think everyone will find something they didn't expect to learn from this book. I think it's a really special book.
It sounds brilliant. And you've paired this with Deep House by Jeremy Atherton Lynn, another guest at the Coast is Queer, may I add. What was the comparison that you made between these two?
So, Deep House is another book that kind of combines memoir and, I guess, cultural history, social history. But it is also a book about migration, and about the way that I suppose migration is often talked about very negatively, but is actually really essential for life and for love for so many people. So Deep House is Jeremy's account of meeting as a young man, meeting the British boy of his dreams in the 90s. They're falling in love. And at the same time, US Congress is preparing the Defense of Marriage Act, which will deny same-sex couples lots of rights, including immigration rights, which essentially means Jeremy and the British boy of his dreams can't legally live together anywhere. So they kind of fly under the radar in various ways. And it becomes Jeremy's attempt to find other couples in history living the way they did, trying to come together over borders. In spite of various things keeping them apart, there's a beautiful line describing the book as an unexpected romantic comedy haunted by centuries of gay ghosts, which I think is a great description of it. But it's about love and borders and being together and being forced apart. And I think that's a nice parallel between the two. They're both beautiful books about very specific incidents that become a story about the whole world.
Absolutely brilliant. Moving on to Nuclear War by Annie Jacobson.
This is the scariest book I've ever read by a long way. It is the author's account of how nuclear war could unfold. And it's kind of minute by minute. So she's chosen a specific scenario, and that first chapter where you would normally have the timestamp saying when this incident started, if you were reading a history book, it says possibly sometime in the near future. And she's used known facts and interviews to create a portrait of what would essentially be the end of the world. And it's terrifying, and also really compelling. It's the kind of book that I kept reading and freaking out and then putting down, but then being so drawn back to it. And it's been hugely popular, which I think is interesting. And it feels odd to recommend it for Christmas, but it's a really good book. So
And you have paired this with two books, but because we create the format, we can also break the format. So we have got here Bunker by Bradley. Sorry, we have got here Bunker by Bradley Garrett and In Love with Love by Ella Risbridger.
I felt like I had to go in two different directions with this recommendation. I think after you've read Nuclear War, either you have to keep reading about that or you have to read something to totally reset your brain. Bunker by Bradley Garrett is a book that I picked up off the shelf in the library, I think because someone else had returned it. It wasn't somewhere that I was really browsing and read so fast and was so in awe of. He's an urban explorer and I think cultural geographer, who's interested in like abandoned spaces a lot of the time, that urban exploration stuff. But in this book, Bunker, he's exploring the world of prepping, people who are building bunkers. And he travels all around the world. So there's lots of different places, lots of different people, lots of different reasons for building their bunkers. But it was brilliant. It was so gripping. The writing is fantastic. Robert McFarlane is a fan, so I think that should tell you something about the writing. It's interested in place and landscape as well as these people. And I think it was a very interesting book to go back to after reading Nuclear War. Bradley's got a bit towards the end where he says preppers actually make him feel very hopeful because if you're prepping, you expect there to be something after the end. And I don't know how hopeful that makes me feel, but I thought it was an interesting perspective that I definitely didn't have before reading the book. And then in contrast, if you've read Nuclear War and you don't want to think about it anymore, In Love with Love by Ella Risbridger is Ella's ode to romantic fiction in all its forms, from Jane Austen to everything we've got these days, romanticy, cowboys, tentacles, all sorts. But it's also really smart. It's smart and funny and passionate. She's taking romantic fiction really seriously, and with a very loving eye. And one of the things that she's thinking about in the book is why, when things are so bad, do we still want to read about love? Why do we want to read about people falling in love? And I think, kind of in the same way that Bradley's saying people are hoping for more after the end, Ella is saying we will always be looking for these hopeful, loving stories about people falling in love with each other and kissing. And I just really like that. I think that's a really beautiful way of talking about storytelling and romance fiction. And I also think it would be a great book to give to someone who would never pick it up for themselves, someone who doesn't read romance fiction, your dad, whoever. Just get someone to think differently about this genre, and I'm sure they will find something in this book that speaks to them.
Brilliant, brilliant. It's actually on my to read pile for this festive season. So the next book, number 3 out of 5, is Challenger by Adam Higginbottom. Tell me about this one.
This is a sort of straightforward recent history book that is just a really compelling story of an incident. It's talking about the explosion of the NASA space shuttle Challenger, which happened in 1986. And Adam is kind of going minute by minute what happened, but also what led up to it and what happened afterwards. It's a great book for anyone in your life that wants to read about history or science or technology. But I also think it's the kind of book you could give to someone who doesn't read a ton of nonfiction. And I think it would make them interested in the genre because it is a page turner. And his way of writing, he's a great storyteller. So it's the kind of book that will turn a fiction reader into a non-fiction reader.
Brilliant. Okay, big claim. So you have paired this with Paradise by Lizzie Johnson.
Yes, until I read Nuclear War, this was the scariest book I'd read this year. Lizzie Johnson reports a lot on wildfires in America, and Paradise is the story of the campfire in 2018 that destroyed a town called Paradise in California. And this year, the book was adapted into a film called The Lost Bus. And the book is, I think, so scary because it feels both completely unavoidable and also completely preventable. Lizzie's talking about climate change. She's talking about big gas and electric companies that are cutting corners and putting people's lives at risk as a result. And the incredibly devastating aftermath of a fire. And again, like with Adam, she's a really good storyteller. So you've got the minute by minute, you've got the lead up, you've got the aftermath, but you're also so drawn into these people's lives, and you feel how much Lizzie cares about it, and how emphatic she is that part of the problem is climate change, which is something I think the film didn't really get across. But it's brilliant. It's a brilliant book.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. So, number 4 out of 5, we've got Supremacy by Palmi Olsen.
This one is a deep dive into the race to create artificial general intelligence, which is a race that has given us ChatGPT. But Palmi is basically looking at the rivalry between two men. Their sometimes quite altruistic, sometimes quite tech-driven desire to work on AI, and how their hopes and dreams kind of became a fight between Microsoft and Google, the way big tech companies take over innovation and turn it into a profit maker. It's fantastic. It was really, really interesting.
How fun. And I think, this is an inevitability of our time. So the more we can learn, the better, surely.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's what Palmi's saying as well. Like, part of the issue is how much is happening behind closed doors, and what's important now is transparency.
Brilliant. So you have paired this with If Then by Jill Lepore. What made you connect these?
So, If Then is about a US data company called Simulmatics, and their kind of Cold War origins. That paved the way for Facebook, for Google, for Cambridge Analytica, for this kind of data-driven, algorithmic way of looking at the world. And I think why I paired the two is it's a really good description of how what's happened in Supremacy, what's happened in Palmi's book, it's just a kind of new version of an old problem. It's not brand new that technology is developing faster than people can deal with it. And in a way, I found that comforting. But in a way, it's also like we're not learning any lessons, clearly. But both of them are just really compelling books about technology and how it changes us and why it matters who's in control of it.
Brilliant. Okay, last but not least, we have question 7 by Richard Flanagan. Tell us about this book.
I almost didn't include this only because it's so hard to talk about. And I wonder if that is why I don't recommend it in the shop as much as I want to, because summarizing it is really difficult. It's kind of memory and history and science. So it's pulling in a lot of themes that I've talked about in some of the other books. But it's also kind of literary criticism. The author is combining a bunch of strands that he sees as connected, and those strands are the affair between the writer H.G. Wells and Rebecca West, 1930s nuclear physics, his father's experience as a prisoner of war not far from Hiroshima, which is where the atom bomb is then dropped, his own near-death experience in Tasmania. And all of these things are kind of showing how interconnected we all are, no matter how far away or distant or big some kind of development or incident might feel. Our lives are all connected, our stories are all connected. And it is just one of the most brilliant books I've read. I underlined most of the sentences in it, but it's a knotty thing. It's really hard to describe. I don't know how, if I had to tell you what genre it was, I don't think I could do it. But it's the kind of book that I think anyone interested in reading about history or books or science or memoir or politics should read. I think lots of people would like it, but I'm not sure many people understand what it is. I'm not sure I understand what it is, but it is fantastic.
And you paired this with That Dark Spring by Susanna Stapleton.
Yes, this is the kind of true crime entry on this list. It's Provence in the 1920s, so similar setting to The Artist by Lucy Steeds from our fiction section. And it is the story of Olive Branson, who is a British artist found dead in very strange circumstances. And the initial investigation concludes that it was suicide. But lots of questions remained, and her family put pressure on the case to be reopened. And this city detective was brought in to look at it again. And I've paired this with Question Seven just because I think it is an example of really well-written non-fiction. These are the books that I'm so glad I went out of my comfort zone from fiction to become a non-fiction reader, because I think these books are really special. And incredibly cleverly written. And Susanna Stapleton in That Dark Spring is talking about art and living a conventional life and somebody moving to a very insular community and shaking things up. And so much of it is so relevant to all sorts of different things, but it's also just a really good mystery. So I think she's done a very good job of writing. I don't know how I feel about the term ethical true crime, but it is. It's she's telling you a mystery, but she's telling you the mystery in a really responsible, thoughtful way. And it was great.
Amazing. That's us. That's our list. So before we go, I'm going to ask you the horrible question, and you can choose a book that you haven't put on this list if you'd like for non-fiction. But what gets your special mention this year?
I think it's got to be Question Seven by Richard Flanagan. In part because I still feel like I'm not doing it justice as a bookseller. Because every time someone asks for a recommendation and I try and explain it to them, they don't know what I'm talking about. But yeah, I think it's got to be Question Seven. And I think if you're buying a book for a reader who's kind of read everything or somebody who is quite difficult to buy for, maybe not even a reader, maybe somebody who doesn't read very often, I think this is a really good one to give to each other.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us and for putting together this brilliant list. I really appreciate it. I know that you think about this a lot through the year. This isn't something that just happens, so I really appreciate your time. We will make sure that all of these books are listed on the Brighton Book Club Instagram page and also in the show notes, on the podcast. How can we find and follow you, Elizabeth, and also sign up to your gorgeous Substack?
So you can find me on Instagram. My username is ec.reads. And then my Substack is Shelf Improvement. And that's where I write a monthly themed recommendations newsletter.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. And one more thing, what book is coming out in 2026 that you are absolutely buzzing for?
Oh, there's so many. Next year is going to be so good for books, but the one that I have to mention is Almost Life by Kieran Millward Hargrave, which is out in March, and is just this stunning story of two women who meet as teenagers in 70s Paris and have this incredibly romantic summer, and then the rest of their lives, things bring them back together. But can they make it work? Can they take their incredible chemistry and put it to work in real life. You've got to read the book to find out. It's so good. If you like The Safekeep, you should read it. Just fantastic, heartbreaking, sexy, stunning.
Thank you very, very much. And happy birthday and Merry Christmas.
Yay! Thank you. Thank you for having me.
1915, the Cab Rack. In the fierce wild beauty of this remote corner of Scotland, an isolated community makes a discovery, an ancient body in a peat bog, perfectly preserved. Two people haul the body from the ground. Lizzie, the wife of a wealthy local landowner, and Johnny, a nomadic singer and farmhand. Soon afterwards, strange events begin to occur. At Hearthside and Inn, people whisper, "What have we unearthed?" As tensions run high and men leave for war, old fears and secrets emerge. But in a place where judgment is swift, who is truly without sin? Gabrielle Griffiths, welcome to the Brighton Book Club and congratulations on the publication of your debut novel, Greater Sins.
Hi, thank you very much.
And welcome to Brighton. I know you've recently moved. What brought you here?
I've been in Brighton for about a year now. I think I just did that classic wanting to escape London but not be too far away type thing. But I kind of always knew that I would live by the sea at some point. So Brighton was perfect for that, and I love how easy it is to get out into the country and all of that. Really enjoying it here.
And what's it like being a writer here? Have you got involved in that much in the writing community?
A little bit, yes. There's a couple of people that I've met through various writing channels and through other writers who also live in Brighton. So that's been really nice because I think, you go somewhere new and you don't necessarily know anybody. So that writing community has been a bit of a way to make some friends.
Absolutely, absolutely. So let's talk about your book, Greater Sins. When did the idea come to you?
It came to me in, I think it was 2020. It was during a break between lockdowns, and I went up to Scotland to see my mum. So she lives about 10 miles away from where the book's set. And we were just out driving one day, I think, and I saw this sign for Cabrach, and I didn't know anything about this area, but for some reason it just piqued my interest. So I went home and started having a look at the kind of history of this place, and found out that it used to be very much a thriving farming community in the region, but during the First World War, a lot of the young men went to fight and didn't come back. But a lot of that was because they got things like measles and other diseases. So because they'd lived so incredibly remotely, they didn't have any protection against things like that. So after that, the farming, they weren't able to continue. There were a couple of really bad winters and people just left the area. And it's now kind of populated, well, very, very sparsely, but there's lots of kind of abandoned crofts and things like that. So it's very haunting, very atmospheric, and just a really interesting place.
So, were you writing before you had the idea for this book, or was it the idea for this book that made you a writer?
Yeah, no, I wasn't really. I mean, I've always loved reading. I've kind of dabbled a little bit here and there with writing, and I suppose writing's always been kind of part of my day job. But no, I hadn't been writing fiction at all. And I think it was just, it was something about this place and this idea that just struck me. And I suppose probably a little bit of, being stuck at home during COVID and wanting something to do. So it was kind of a done on a whim, I suppose, and I just ran with it.
And it definitely paid off. It's a brilliant book. So, Greater
Yeah.
Sins sits in the folk horror genre. Was it quite obvious quite quickly that you were going to write a book in this genre? Or do you think it did that come over time?
I think it's kind of hard to categorize in a way, because it probably has strands of lots of different things. It changed a lot over the time that I was writing it. I think I don't really know what it was going to be to start with. I think I had it in mind it would be more of a ghost story, but as I started writing, it turned into much more of an exploration of the characters and their lives at that time and the sort of constraints that would be on certain people in society based on their gender, their class, things like that. So I'm not sure it's super horror, just, so people aren't disappointed. But yeah, I definitely leaned into the kind of folkloric element because that's something that I'm really interested in.
Can you read some for us, please?
Yes, I can. So I'm going to just read from the opening. So this is with Johnny, who is our kind of itinerant ploughman, I suppose, sitting in the inn in the Cabrach. A toast to himself for getting by unseen. Outside are the folks who'll want things from him. So first, alone, a drink. Johnny has his ritual. Slip a hand round a cool glass. Feel the weight as it rises heavenward. Agnes has lit the paraffin lamps despite the bright day, and so he holds the dram before the light to admire its syrupped beauty. He brings the whiskey to his lips and pauses, lets the scent beguile him. Peat sweet, a sigh in the nose. But as Johnny opens his mouth to drink, something disturbs him. A noise slips under the door, a plaintive keening that starts low, then swells like the river in spate. It is not a babby's cry, but something wilder, the lavish wail of a woman. Johnny lowers his dram and waits. If there is trouble, it'll surely come strutting in. The cry rises higher until the chatter outside ceases and it hovers in the air above the inn, then stops, clipped. Sad day for someone, Agnes says. Johnny shrugs. The Cabrach is not a place for great displays of emotion. Its people know hardship and they know loss, and it's expected they won't fall down weeping about either. Outside, talk resumes. Johnny begins his routine again. The grasp, the lift, the tilt, then the first mouthful. A sharpness on the tip of the tongue, the land made liquid. The heather and the hay and the cold, clear water, the tang of the midden that gets into everything. No trouble has found him.
Thank you so
Read
much.
on to find out what.
Absolutely. Or listen to the audiobook, which I did and thought was absolutely brilliant. So you said in an interview, Gabrielle, that you love testing a reader's sympathies towards a character. What did you mean by this, and how did you do
Yeah.
it with your protagonists, Lizzie and Johnny?
So I really like the idea of challenging, whether a reader will kind of like a character all the way through a book. And I think that can be quite a difficult thing to pull off, but I never want a character to be perfect in every way. I really want them to be well-rounded people, and that means that, they do things that are cruel or mean or grubby or just shameful and not very nice. And so it was really important that I brought that to my main characters, I suppose. But I think there's a way of going about it in terms of kind of getting the reader to vouch for these people, to be behind them and be rooting for them. But then later on, kind of test how far that rooting for them goes. I mean, I suppose it's like not so much pulling the rug from under people, but yeah, just challenging their perceptions as we go through the novel.
And the dual narrative, what did you do to get into Lizzie and Johnny's heads and voices?
I just rewrote their sections lots and lots of times, I think. What did I do? It was funny because Johnny came to me really clearly, and I always found his sections a lot easier to write. Whereas I think I found Lizzie quite difficult. I mean, I would do things like go for long walks at lunchtime and almost talk in their voices in my head. So not necessarily kind of about what was happening in the book, but just about like their lives more widely or what they thought about things. And it got to the point where they really lived for me outside of the book, and like they live for me now. Like I can imagine what they're doing. So yeah, I think it's just a case of spending a lot of time with them, really.
Absolutely. So you had, what looks like a really brilliant journey to publication, going from writing a book in 2020 to, having a two book deal with, with Penguin, which is absolutely brilliant. Can you please tell us what happened? So you had the idea for the book, you wrote a draft, then what did you do to get to where you are now?
Yeah, so when I was kind of, halfway through a first draft, maybe, or maybe even a little bit before that. I was fortunate to get chosen for a mentorship program at a literary agency, which was partly about kind of developing your manuscript and also just exposing you to different people around the publishing agency. So, publishers, agents, other writers, things like that. So, I kind of had that early vote of confidence in the book and in the writing, which I think was really helpful. Because it showed me that there was potential in it and in me and what I was doing. So I did that for a bit, and then I did end up changing agents around about, I think it was January 2023. So by that time, I had a completed manuscript that I'd taken as far as I could get it without sort of somebody else's input, really. And I was fortunate to get my agent, who I've got now, Daisy, within a few weeks. So that was great. We worked together for a few months, just tweaking things, making some further edits, and then we went out on submission around about June 2023. And I got the deal in July with Doubleday. So that was really amazing. They're a really great publisher. And then, yeah, it's such a long time between getting the deal and the book coming out. So there was a lot of patience needed, which isn't always my strong point. But there's lots to do in that time period as well, because you're working with your editor to make further changes. There weren't too many kind of big structural or plot changes, but there were a few things around character and that side of things. And then obviously there's the more fine sort of line edits, which that was a weird experience. I think when you kind of get your book back and it's like heavily commented on and there's a lot of track changes, it's like almost a fear that it's not going to sound like your voice anymore. But actually, as I got into it, I realized it was very much the case of just like stripping away excess words, and it like really helped everything to become very clean and honed and really helped, I think. There's lots to do around the cover and the sort of marketing side as well. So that kind of year and a half was very much interspersed with little bursts of activity and things before it eventually came out in March this year.
And what's it like to be a published author? Like, what's the reaction from people been? Has your life changed?
It's a funny one, really, because I think you kind of expect your life to change more than it does, maybe. I mean, when I got the book deal, I dropped a bit of time in my sort of day job so that I would have focused time to write. And I think that for me was quite a big moment, because it was taking writing from something that was, a hobby that I did at the weekends and in the evenings, to something that was work, but in a good way. Like, it meant that I could really take it seriously. But yeah, I mean, it's funny because it's such a momentous thing to happen. And around publishing date, you've got like your book launch and all these exciting things happen. And then it kind of like goes back to your real life. I think there's been some aspects of it which have been a bit more challenging, but I'm really proud of it. And I guess people that I tell are always quite excited by it, so that's nice, and it helps to like keep up my excitement about it as well.
Absolutely. And you got a two-book deal, which means you are either working on or have finished your second book.
Very, very much still working on. It's the thing that everybody says about the second book is about it being difficult is very, very true for me. I've written lots of kind of part drafts of different novels, and struggled to kind of decide which one to do, or kind of ran out of steam, I suppose. So at the moment, I've kind of got two that I'm alternating between. Because I think I got to that point where it was feeling a bit of a slog, and so I started writing something else because I wanted it to be fun again and just do something that I enjoyed. And maybe it won't turn into anything that's publishable, but I think it's quite good to just explore and have fun and not get too bogged down in the slog of it, I suppose.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Gabrielle. How can people find and follow you and get their hands on a copy of Greater Sense?
So I'm on Instagram. God, I can't remember my handle now. I think it's Gabrielle _ Griffiths, but probably if you search my name, it'll be on there. And Greater Sins is available from all good bookshops. It's in hardback at the moment. The paperback comes out in early February, I believe, but also ebook, audiobook, all of that.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to our Christmas book recommendation special and listening to the wonderful Gabrielle Griffiths there talking about her brilliant new book. This is our last show of the year, but don't worry, we will be back very soon with another brilliant show. We are going to be talking new year, new reads. We've got a brilliant, brilliant episode lined up for you. We're going to have on the show Brighton-based authors Kirsty Lower, Victoria Adeniji West, Catherine Bradley and Hattie Williams. We would love to know what your favourite books of the year were. So you can email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com and tell us there. Or you can comment on our Instagram post, which is pinned to our grid at BTM Book Club. As ever, if you want to get in touch, you know how to do it. Please do subscribe to the podcast wherever you get yours and consider giving us a review. It helps more people see it. And if you are a local writer in Brighton, Sussex or the surrounding areas, or if you are doing something brilliant book related in the city or beyond, we would absolutely love to hear from you for next year. So take care, everybody, and we will see you next month.
Precious.